Let's begin. Everyone said that. From the list of questions in my notes, there was a question about your relationship to Congress. There was this thing of saying that government or cabinet minister should tell public protector what to investigate and what not. Mm-hmm. I think that what one wanted to say was that the advice to say, maybe we should also say that if one agency investigating an issue, rather await for the conclusion of it, see the report, and see if there's still a need to follow up on it. That's all that matters.
No, here you can put that. I think that the minister is aware of our views on this matter. I think in a situation where ministers or departments want to come in the middle of an investigation, it's not appropriate. And it's for them then to go back to that other institution and say, please wait the outcome of public protective investigation. That's unfair. I went as far as to say, please tell us who these people are. That's still my view, by the way. On this matter?
Yeah.
All right.
I do think the point that public sector has made in the initial dialogue is important, and it's been evidenced by the discussions ended today, and we can't acknowledge now. But, I mean, that also tends to be problematic, because then someone would say, well, whatever unit is dealing with that, so you can't, and then it doesn't hit finance for 2 or 3 years down the line, because actually you have delayed that. So, and those issues need to be discussed and debated, and I think we all agree now that the issue of accountability is that we will accept that the public sector is accountable to Parliament. The issue is how is that accountability exercised, and to what extent does that accountability go. And I think those are the issues we need to find out. And I'm sure we discussed this last year also, and asked the OIFD to assist us with some research on matters. But I haven't seen, so I don't know if they've done it or not. But, I mean, I'm sure I raised it last year as well. The issue is how is
the challenge faces is if a particular institution is engaged in an investigation, then the public protector's office is asked midway through that institution to now intervene. That becomes a problem. But where the public protector's office has begun an investigation and is ceased, you can't then say to the office, no, please step aside. We want someone else to do it. That's not us.
I think we agree with that. I think it's going to be good. Yeah, we can't accept.
But I
don't think
it's not necessarily the other way around. Because, I mean, I've had an investigation that's supposedly being investigated by the hall for 2 years and there's nothing being done about it. So you can't say they're busy with an investigation when they're actually not. Well, we don't know if they are. And then you use that as an excuse not to let the public get to the
hall. Well, you're in that case then as Parliament is exercise our powers.
Yeah.
And call them in and say, why aren't you doing this? So, let me finish, please. Your letter to Parliament about a portfolio committee or a committee of Parliament delaying a particular matter that was raised by Ms. Smuts. Right. Remember, she said the chairperson is not here. Okay. Then Ms. Schaefer referred to cases of corruption, and whether you have referred any of these to the books and or the scientific research. And if you have, which are those, and can we have details of those? Mr. Sibanuni's questions about Konkanga and Kumbalala, I think you've noted those. They haven't been responded to. Prof. Damandana's questions about the training of the staff of your office. And then later he spoke about an Accords hospital. And then Advocate Adams's question about a report on the Uganda investigation. Those are some of the questions you get to respond to. Yes, you have noted those, have you?
Thank you, Honourable Members, for the privilege again to continue to address you. There was one last question that I had not dealt with on the land links that came from Honourable Speaker, you are right about the UK letter being in trouble. And you asked whether this is an area where our office could have intervened and done a study. I must indicate that we are faced with issues of land claims, simply from a purely from a maladministration point of view. Virtually every province has given us a request to investigate land claims matters. Some of them are around delays. Over the years, we're investigating delays. Increasingly, there are other matters. The late Judge President had requested a meeting with me about corruption in the land claims program. I was not able to meet with him, and I understand that even when he was in hospital, he wanted us to meet. But he did speak with his colleagues about some of the issues, and it's something that is on the program. I requested a meeting with Minister McGuinty, and has written back to me to say we should meet to discuss delays, corruption, and maladministration by traditional authorities and the Community Property Association, CPA. And just generally, during the poverty study, or the poverty public hearing, land claims program came out as a full issue. We do know, Honourable Chairperson, that restoring land to people was about giving them resources so that they could look after themselves and generate income for themselves and look after themselves, and cease to be a burden to the state. The information we've got in all of the nine provinces is that in many of those communities, people only just got a piece of paper that says you have your land back. It is not a resource in their hands that is helping them to employ themselves and to generate wealth. That is the allegation, and then there is a serious allegations of maladministration. Some of the allegations are really in our investigations, individual investigations. In Mpumalanga, when we gave a report back to the Premier, he indicated that he's aware of the problems of corruption, maladministration, and lack of capacity by the people to manage these huge resources. Because we did indicate to him that people don't have this capacity of managing huge amounts of land that have mineral resources or for agriculture requires a very sophisticated enterprise, and then we're giving very simple people the task with minimum support. Here in Mpumalanga, he is convening a summit to discuss everything around land restitution. At national, I don't know what the Minister Mpumalanga is going to come up with, but there is a need for a national review of what has happened, the delays in processing. But the major concern from our side, Honourable Mutaka, is those that have gotten the net back, but it means nothing to them. And that's the feedback that we've given to government in all of the provinces where we met the legislature and the Premier and the Honourable Shiko.
So, now, one suggestion I make is some of these things are part of the corruption, because people delay the land claims,
and Islam allows people the right to prospect.
Yes, sir.
And then by the time you get the land, the mineral rights are gone. And sometimes they allocate the land to someone to develop. By the time you have to get the land, then they say, no, it's not possible to restitute the land. And then take things. So at the end, the whole restitution process really becomes a joke. And lastly, there is no also respect for the meaning of the word community in the African sense. In the African sense, you have a king, a senior traditional leader, who has been winners, they were disobedient. Now, they were not disposed as individuals. Now, when they came, you say, no, let individuals who were physically removed come, and they come as a group, then you say, form a community association, which means the function of the community association is to destroy the nationhood of the people. So again, there's the problem of understanding of the constitution, understanding of what a community is. So it may even be at the end of the day that the land restitution act is unconstitutional, because if the constitution recognizes a community observing indigenous law, but the restitution says, no, come as individuals, you are a group, and then form a CPA, and then the CPA competes for authority with the traditional community. So it's a very serious problem. So to be waiting for a summit in December, and then the problem is deepening. Maybe you are approached, then you must have a conversation. We also will have to be in a conversation in this other thing before our people are going to choose one another because of the fault of them.
Thank you, Honorable. Your summary is spot on. A lot of the issues that you have raised are in the piles of written submissions that we have received from people in Mpumalanga, Northern Cape, Northwest in particular, and two communities here in the Western Cape. There are problems around the delay and the handling of the land in between. All I can promise the committee for now is that Minister Kubenti has now agreed to a meeting. We will raise all of these issues and then ask him what could be done in the meantime. Are there interventions that could expedite the process without waiting for a summit? I do think that Mpumalanga's choice to have a summit was not a good thing, because there's just so much dissatisfaction, there's so much pain around communities that have been given their land back. There's been pain of communities who are still waiting. The lady, some say that the land has been given back, but it's not given to them, it's given to someone else. Mm-hmm. So we have a whole range of a systemic problem around the land. Thank you, Honorable Mutaka. I'm going to now go to Honorable Schaefer. Honorable Schaefer, in the absence of Honorable Fuad, I had run a bit of... I'm sorry. In the absence of Honorable Smart, I just did a bit of googling of the order, because we have all of them on the website. I have a report here that show that justice accounted at the time for 14% of the complaints that had been received by the public protector in the year 2007. This is the year 2006, and that is long before I became the protector. It was one of the highest ones. But you can look at it and find over the years justice was always. Then Section 6 of that report of that case was on specific investigations, and the first investigation was against the National Assembly. Okay. This is 2006-07. That's the joys of the internet. Quickly and in real time go back. I just wanted to confirm to this parliament that I'm not the one that changed the rules of the game. I found a system like this that worked with it. Thank you, ma'am. It was report on investigation into alleged failure to comply with the constitution and parliamentary procedures. it is the Constitution 12th Amendment Bill. I just presented one example just to show that the debate about the jurisdiction of the office only starts last year. Over the years, this committee has not questioned the jurisdiction. And yet it was doing the same thing. Thank you. But let me now then go to the Honourable Schaefer's issue. I'm not sure how you see it. We have the power to take appropriate legal action. And that is certainly what Section 182.1c says. It says the public protector has the power to investigate, report, and then Section 182.1c specifically says to take appropriate legal action. It has always been read as being a very open-ended provision that gives discretion on how to deal with it. And Honourable Monsieur reminded us that I shouldn't read the Constitution alone. I do agree. The only issue that I was raising, sir, was that you cannot read the legislation to reduce the powers, because the Constitution gives the powers. Legislation, the Constitution specifically says that you have additional powers that is given by legislation. So if the legislation then reduces the powers from us, that, or is read to reduce the powers that are given by the Constitution, then that would be. That is all that I was raising. But just going back to that, and the Public Protector Act repeats similar wording from the Constitution about findings. Unfortunately, the section in the investigation, I think it's Section 6, no, Section 7. Section 7 deals with how we investigate. Somewhere it says in the middle of an investigation, but you're still in investigation and when issues come up, you may recommend that action be taken. In other words, you don't wait until you make findings under Section 8, you may recommend. But because other ombudsmen have only the power to recommend, that is the tendency then is to say, no, you can only recommend, you can't take appropriate legal action. It often creates problems. But we are not experiencing that as a big issue. Most of us on stage just want to engage because nobody wants to do something unlawful. Nobody wants to waste 6 years on it. So Honourable Schaefer, at the time we were raising some of these issues in the annual report, we had difficulty with the Mpumalanga one, the money they took to Italy, and we were worried that there wasn't full implementation. In terms of Section 8, then I could request that data be tabled in Parliament, and the common practice in other countries is that if I've requested a table in Parliament, I am then requested to come and read my report and present my report and indicate what my findings were and why I reached those findings, and then the committee debates. And then the committee will then go and call the agency that is refusing to implement and find out why are they not implementing. But that's how in other countries it's done. And for me, that's kind of strengthening constitutional democracy. Even in the provinces, when there's no implementation, we firstly try to go to the legislature and the council, the agency and municipality, to strengthen their oversight role, which means we combine our... We are the technical investigation. They use their normal oversight powers to enforce. It was in that context that was raised. Yes.
We're doing what we are thinking we should be doing. Yes, we are.
My question really was, what if Parliament doesn't agree with the recommendation? But your analysis thing would be that the body that's being asked to come and say why they aren't implemented, they could then raise certain points, and then you could take those as your
The points can be raised, but they can't raise points for findings. The universal approach, again, is that the debate is not around findings, because the ombudsman, even in the UK, where the ombudsman has a power, two powers, we all have powers to make findings, which is to make a determination, and then we have the legal action powers. Different ombudsman institutions have different powers. Others, Kenya is more like us, we have the power to take appropriate legal action, because Kenya has two power constitutions. But in the UK, then their legal action says they can recommend legal action. meaning then there has to be debate around that. But it is not known for Parliament to debate the findings of an ombudsman. I would be interested in something like that. That's something that, again, what we do as ombudsmen is we share this on the internet and then we say, search for me, have you ever seen this done? And then we research and then we tell each other what to do. What are we doing?
Chair, bear with me. I'm new on the committee. I'm not sure what the meaning of remedial is. I thought that it's either you have a decision that is enforceable and there must be someone who enforces the decision. Now, in this case, when we talk about remedial action, what does it actually mean? It's not only for you, I just mean that I want to understand what it is generally understood by all of you.
Honourable, I think that's something that probably would go to another debate. My understanding at the moment is that remedial action is a remedy. In fact, incidentally, there's a report we wrote recently where we engaged with the organ of state involved around those concepts. What is remedial action? If you talk about a remedy, is that if you say, for example, if I pour this water and then you want me to remedy the situation, that means I have to give you the water back, or something equivalent to the water. Otherwise, it's not remedial action, it's to pick what's broken. That's our understanding of remedial action. But in ombudsman circles, we don't remedy it the way the courts do. For example, if a person keeps you without an ID for 5 years, and the Department of Education makes you wait for the trip results for 2 years, and you spend the years of your life, 7 years of your life, and this happened with Mr. Kainile, in UK, the remedial action would be that Mr. Kanyele is given exactly what he lost. You know, he would be given the equivalent of what he would have gone, because he already had a university scholarship from UAZ, which he lost during the 7 years of the state maladministration. In ombudsman circles, then we put you as close as possible to where you have been, but we take into account the circumstances of the respondent institution. Because, for example, Home Affairs gets it so wrong many times, we have avoided at the moment to insist that Home Affairs pays you back more or less what you lost, because they would become insolvent. But in other cases, when they get it wrong and we see issues that can be fixed, it's like 20,000. 50,000, 100,000, we do that. There is a case that would repay equitable life in the UK, where the government was made to pay money to pensioners because it was failed to regulate properly. Government refused to pay exactly the remedial action, and the complainants took the matter to court. And the court said government must pay. The only way remedial action may not be implemented is if you can make a determination that the ombudsman was irrational. In other words, a reasonable ombudsman faced with the same circumstances would not have arrived at a decision. But the question that arises is, who makes that decision? You can't make a decision if I'm judging you, because then you become your own judge, or you become the review authority, you are now reviewing me. If you're not happy with me, then you feel that it's better that you take it to another authority, because it says the institutions are ultimate. And they are subject to the law and the constitution. And my approach is really the same approach we take to the Auditor General. When the Auditor General then cuts us, we accept that that is the authority that is given to the Auditor General at the constitution. Honourable Schaefer, my request was saying that I may approach this Parliament to request a proper debate on a case where there is failure to implement, and then they'll take it, and they'll just do it like in other country and take it through and to its ultimate conclusion and see how far it goes, whether the institution consent can give us rational reasons for non-implementation. Thank you. Now, you then say, why should you give us more money when we're not handling this money problem? I have indicated, Honourable Schaefer, the one thing where is the big money, the 13 million, the 13 million relates to the case management system, which was not purchased before I became involved. But there are other issues that have been raised around us looking after our own things properly, as we are sorting out those. They don't relate to loss of money, though, honourable members. I must just indicate they relate the findings in relation to current, our current situation, relates to non-payment of suppliers within 30 days. And then there were those that were paid without a valid test clearance certificate. It was a copy. And that is before last. We picked up something that happened in previous years, and that we've corrected. You can't use a copy of the test clearance certificate because people forge in. But the rules are the rules. And there isn't money that I can say, honorable shape, that we haven't spent the money across the field. We are trying by all means from our side to cut down on expenses in everything that we do so that we can push some of the money towards investigations. The only area where we have tried with our own money to remedy the situation, we have increased people's salaries, although treasury being it was not a wise move. The truth is, if you are a small institution, losing people is more traumatic than a big institution, institutional memory. You will see, for example, that we lost our CFO to a municipal entity. That destabilized us. We had a CFO that died shortly before I became public protector. When I became public protector, they had just employed a CFO, and that didn't work out. There were problems. After that, then we employed a young female CFO. Things were going very well. Then she's taken away, and because our pay was lower, we then looked out, and then with the assistance of treasury, eventually we were able to counter offer her, but the grass was still much greener on the other side. We've now lost our supply chain manager to the same entity. He moves from a deputy director position to a chief director position. I think for us, that is a problem around keeping people and using the little money that we have. Is corruption increasing, honourable members? There's no doubt in my mind. That also answers honourable words. Corruption is increasing. All agencies are saying the same thing. Auditor General, the NIU is saying the same thing. The Minister and the Presidency, the Public Service Commission. Initially, you asked me this question, Honourable Chairperson, whether corruption was increasing. I was hesitant. I think I only asked that question positively this year. I think you said our caseload was increasing, but that wasn't necessarily indicative of the fact that corruption itself was increasing, because a lot of the cases that we're getting were about things that happened in the past. But we're getting complaints about things that are happening today. With this increase, there's also sophistication, Honourable Schaefer. It is not the kind of corruption where you can track the bribes and things like that easily. We have had one case where there is a clear bribe, where somebody asked for a bribe and it was one of those people that would say in America's families criminal because he asked for a bribe by SMS. But you don't get those all the time. Most of it is extremely, extremely sophisticated. What we can tell you, without mentioning the cases, what we can tell in the specific cases that have dealt with them is that linked to corruption is tender rigging and price escalation and unreasonable pricing, because we believe that everyone in the value chain then has to be paid. The tender rigging that is taking place, you get a tender that doesn't violate supply chain rules. Everything is done by the book. The only thing is that there are people in that value chain that know what their job is. They will score people ridiculously low, and then eventually everyone is eliminated, and the preferred person moves up all by themselves. We do have a report that we submitted, I think, last year, or early last year, around that, and we're dealing with something like, we've issued a provisional report where you're going to see something like that happening. If we don't act on corruption, it will grow bigger than all of us. That is a fact, Honorable Chairperson. If we don't act on corruption, it will overcome us. Many bouncers, have we received letters to some? Yes, the team at the moment is trying to get the exact numbers, but there are letters that have been received by us. In some cases, there has been prosecution. There have been, but we don't refer to courts when we have investigated conclusively. We will only refer to the courts when we have investigated and been able to conclude the part on criminality. For example, there's one report we issued where they did an internal disciplinary inquiry for 50 million rand. For three people, the internal disciplinary inquiry cost 15 million rand, meaning for each person it cost 5 million. We suspected there was criminality, but we didn't conclude the criminal part. And the portfolio committee that had asked us to do the investigation had asked us that we do it jointly. It was going to be us, the Hawks, the Public Service Commission, and the Hawks. So by the time we concluded ours, we were able to integrate the work done by the Public Service Commission and the Auditor General, but not the Hawks. So the Hawks are following up on the relationship to see what really happened there. Yvonne, why is it high target? During the break, we were discussing whether this is the time when I then threw in the towel. Again, when I did this research earlier about what my colleagues did, they still were trying to do any resolution, even though they didn't call any resolution letters within 3 months, and then the other ones within a year, and then if they exceeded a year, they need to do so. I must acknowledge, Honorable Chairperson, that it is all my fault. The Auditor General did say we should extend timeline. The team did say we should extend timeline. I will talk to my team now to see whether we really should finally extend this timeline. And I've indicated, though, that to the person on the street, it's called comfort to say, I'll take 2 years to deal with your case because I'm afraid that I will get an audit finding. I tighten the controls. The reality being that once we push it to 2 years, we can't hold the investigators to a tighter standard. At the moment, once cases are aging, we call them aging disgracefully, and when they are almost all cases over the year, we pull out all stops to try and prevent them from aging disgracefully. We will continue to do that, but we'll see whether we can adjust our targets so that we don't get an audit fine. Because then we can get ourselves 100% audit finding if we just improve, if we just adjust the timeline.
I understand what you're saying in a certain sense, but in another sense it doesn't really make sense, because the point is you're already getting an audit fine because you aren't helping out with those targets. So you're already taking that long anyway. So you tell the people you're in the 2 years, but you're in fact 2 years. That's the same thing. So maybe you want to go somewhere in between, and then you can get happy medium.
Thank you, Honorable Schaefer. We are exceeding, but still people push hard because they know that the year was going to be 1 year. If now you're pushing for 2 years, the standards are less because the performance agreements are going to affect that. But perhaps 18 months or something. This is something, it's arriving at a good time because we now have to revise our strategy for it and say until better resources, what we do. Of course, we keep trying to benchmark with our colleagues because obviously for them their ultimate deadline is 6 months. If a case has taken more than 5 months in Denmark, the ombudsman has to be called by the committee to explain to the committee why they took more than 5 months. So maybe we were benchmarking against people that have better resources than we do. But taking into account that people do really struggle and they would like justice to be sweet. Regarding the staff members, Honorable Shaysan, I apologize. The 284,000 was a mistake. The staff members are 284 in the year under review. And in the years that we're in, we have increased our staff complement minimally. However, with the introduction of the trainee investigators, we appointed 100 of them. We cannot classify them as really staff members because they're all in a state of flux, and secondly, they cannot investigate all by themselves, although they do an excellent job in supporting us. Honorable Ford, you asked about corruption. It reached a tipping point then. Has it tipped over? I hope to God that it hasn't tipped over. I don't know. All I can say to this nation and to this committee is that corruption in this country has reached crisis proportions. There are no two ways about it. And I do appeal to all structures that are involved in oversight, because it is a joint problem, that we need to find a way to join hands to deal with corruption. It has reached crisis proportions. How do we... Do we think that whistleblowers are protected as they honorable staff, you already got the document from the Deputy Public Protector, which was primarily talking to the difficulties that are there in protecting whistleblowers. The whistleblowers are not adequately protected. This Justice Committee was at some stage reviewing the Protective Disclosures Act. I'm aware of that because when we were in the commission, we did a paper on the protection of whistleblowers. Did it come to the commission? Not yet. All right, the South African Law Reform Commission was, at the time I was still a commissioner, busy with reviewing the Protective Disclosures Act. Because then again, certainly the class of people that is protected is not inclusive. At that stage, the Act excluded temporary workers, so you have to be a full-time employee to be protected as a whistleblower. Number two, it did not protect suppliers. If you are dealing with a tender, as it has happened in one case that we're dealing with, if you whistleblow and then they retaliate, blatantly retaliate, there's nothing in the law that says they cannot retaliate. And there's no, in the current age also, it doesn't specifically indicate what is retaliation action. If you go to many states in the U.S., there are examples that are given in the law on what is retaliatory action. Because people don't dismiss you for whistleblowing. They will dismiss you for something else, very, very minor. For example, in one state that I visited a while ago, I think it's medicine, then you're not allowed to initiate disciplinary proceedings against a whistleblower on something they did long before they whistleblew, because that is indicating that you suddenly remembered their sins because they whistleblew. You can proceed with disciplinary action only if you can prove that that person possibly whistleblew because they were avoiding disciplinary action, which is possible by the whistleblower who gets wind of the fact that HR is about to initiate proceedings and then whistleblow. And that is to make proceedings. And then there's a whole lot of prohibitions around things that you cross do with whistleblowers. The second thing around whistleblowing that has been mentioned by ODEC, which is the organization that has done an incredible amount of work around that area, is the protection of whistleblowers from criminal action. We have the Witness Protection Act, but there isn't a direct link currently between the Protective Disclosures Act and the Witness Protection Act. If, for example, we say the Auditor General and the Protector are safe harbors, But there's nothing that else that says once you have reported to me or to the Auditor General, I have the power to assist you to get into witness protection. So you would have to go through the criminal justice system to be assisted to get into the witness protection program, which does go protect whistleblowers, and we think some of them being protected under the Honourable Watson, who is out at the moment. That is as far as I can go, just to say that the South African Law Reform Commission is looking at including the Protected Detention Act. From my side, I indicated last year to this committee that when the opportunity arises to review that act, there should be also consideration of bounty provisions, as in the US stands. Because a lot of people speak out the net to the whistleblowers. In the US, if the people are prosecuted successfully for things such as false billing, which is happening a lot now, people billing for service not done. Beyond RVP, there are other areas where people are billing for services that they haven't done, and they get paid for it. If you are a whistleblower and you can prove that in the US, the people are subsequently prosecuted, in some of the states you can get 25% of the money recovered. If the state does not prosecute, you choose to prosecute on your own, you may get about 40% of the money that you recovered. I don't think it's something we can just throw away like that. It's something that we should seriously consider, because auditing and other measures do not pick up most of the fraud that happens in public, particularly in procurement and in abuse of funds. Things like whistleblowing, in fact, most of the major things that we investigate are because of whistleblowing. Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Swan. You said there are not enough people that are being prosecuted. Honourable Swan, I think, was concerned that I said there aren't enough people that are being disciplined. We will indicate in some of the reports that we've written around the problems around discipline. There is a member of the Parliament that said we're doing work of the Inspector General of Intelligence. I think it was Honourable... you will have to just advise that we would not want to take on the job. But if there are cases that maybe quietly you could mention to me where you think the Inspector General of Intelligence could have done that, I would look at it. The assessment team at the Public Protector's Office does assessment. I just had the final say later, and I rarely ever change the findings. But the first thing is firstly jurisdiction, and then the second issue is discretion. If there is an agency that can deal with it, my team is usually happy to push it to that agency because it's minus one trouble. So if it's letters dealing with intelligence, we send it to the Inspector General of Intelligence. There are letters that she brings, she has one or two letters that she's brought to us, not from us. Matters that were sent to her, where the party thought they were intelligence related, but she thought they were ours. We have MOUs with all of these agencies. Police matters, we rarely do them. Prisons, I haven't seen a prison matter in a long time, whereas we used to do a lot of them until we met with the Judicial Inspectorate of Prisons, and we signed an MOU. And they've done excellent work in educating the people to go there. Please let her go to the director's petition. I don't know, I would be guided. With Decline, for example, since we assisted them to create the ombudsman, the military ombud, we sent letters to the military ombud. We also support that institution to grow itself in terms of its ability to handle these matters. I was then Honourable Sibanyoi. Thank you for reminding us about Sibanyoi. we haven't forgotten about it. It is part of our intended mobile services. We will continue to provide them with mobile services. We haven't had time. We intended to go there to meet the community because they had also formally complained about taking away the service. We wanted to just go to them to explain to them how this new service is going to operate. At the level of staff, they interacted with the community to indicate what we're planning. But when I get time, I will go there. We have like services and our mobile clinic will be operational. The hospital in Kwamhlanga, since they are close by, we could visit them at some stage. Most of the places that we visited, we chose them by the public protector provincial representative. So the person in the province decided where we went. So we just went where we were sent. However, we received a special request. Like we went to Orange Farm on the request, and we could consider Kwamhlanga. In fact, we haven't done much in Pretoria because the tendency is that they know where to find us. Our training is provided by main service providers. Their training on food examination was provided by the Association of Food Examiners. It's a certified, it's a proper organization that if you call yourself a food examiner, you've got to train with them and then you're given a certificate that allows you to call yourself a fraud examiner. They are global. On investigations, we have had some of our, most of our investigators were trained by the Ombudsman of Ontario, Andre Barim, who conducts a global course that is called Sharpen Your Teeth. That course is recommended by the International Ombudsman Institute, and it is offered annually by the International Ombudsman Institute. But we had him come here because it's more expensive to send one or two people to Vienna or to Ontario. He came here and he trained our people. Some were trained here in Durban. We think most of our training, Honorable Zabandaba, is now going to be done in Durban. We have an institute there. It's called the African Ombudsman Institute. And Ms. Advocate Border Singh, who is sitting there next to Ms. Young, is the person who is currently the acting director in charge of the Ombudsman Institute, which does research of the entire Ombudsman group in Africa, research and training, and funded by DECO. Whilst I'm at that, we just also formally introduce the lady sitting next to her. Her name is Natalie. Her name is Danita Young. For the first time, we now have employed a parliamentary liaison officer. She's the international relations plus parliamentary liaison. I'm hoping it will improve our relations with Parliament, where everything is going to be coordinated at one point, and also introducing to use that to make sure that the issues that are pending issues are sorted out at the Secretariat level. Back to Honourable Dabandaba on what is causing tender rigging. I can only concur with the Auditor General that the main fault line is non-compliance. The rest is probably greed and all sorts of things, but what opens the door is non-compliance, when institutions are not putting them compliance, which is going to create difficulty when I go to answer the Honourable Shopping, which is the next one that I have to attend to. If we increase a budget, will we gain more insight on this matter? Certainly, we believe that with a better budget, we can deal with individual cases, but we can also stop the waterfalls in certain areas. We believe that with a better budget, we'll have more power to investigate fast, and if we can help to reverse a particular contract that is properly issued, it is reversed immediately. But if it takes forever to investigate, if you complete the investigation in 2 years, by then the implementation is far too long and there isn't much you can do to get the money back. you will see in some of the things that they were reporting on. But where we've acted fast, it's been possible to totally reverse the situation. And hence we plead for that budget. Okay, we've been asked to intervene in Makoti Hospital. We were only asked via the media, just writing in the media and saying that the professor should intervene. Nobody asked us directly. However, when we followed the process, Honourable Professor Mandela, we thought that the process was now moving smoothly because the minister then intervened and is making sure that the hospital is not going to be closed. The only thing we're going to do is to follow up with the office. We're working with the chief director to just find out if the allegations of maladministration that led to the closure are going to be investigated by the Minister of Health. Again, if the Minister of Health can sort it out, we don't have to investigate. We need to check the case. Honourable Mandation, thank you so much for your kind words. And, Honourable, thank you for your kind words. I just want to say thank you on behalf of the team, because what I call my team to do is what I call myself to do, is just to do our best. We never claim to be the best in the country. We just want to be better than yesterday. Every day we have to do our personal best as an institution and our personal best as an individual. And if that is meeting some of the expectations, we are grateful for that. And we hope next year we can go to 90%. If the team learns that, that would be great. Right. And thank you for the comment about seniors. For me, the thank you goes to them as well for opening their doors and wanting to meet with my team and being open to listening to the feedback we're giving them and undertaking to then own the program going forward to make sure that it will be enforced from their side rather than from our side. I have explained, Honourable Shopesitor, I have explained better today, the case management system is an old problem, which we are now resolving. But the principle that you raised, though, that I can't blame other people in my office when things go wrong, is the right principle. It is my job to ensure that my office is functional. When anything has not gone right, I can't come to the committee or to anyone and say it is Mr. So-and-so's fault or Mr. So-and-so's fault or some other person's fault. I have to take responsibility and that I have to appreciate. You asked them that on the question of training of people who violate supply chain management rules, we should not simply say we are going to train people. That's true. The training is the main part of the answer, just to make sure that people remember what exactly needs to be done, including new people. Policies are also part of our solution, making sure policies. The other thing that we didn't indicate in the report is that we are in the process of employing a compliance officer. We should have employed one by June, but the people that we were trying to employ, when they went for the competency test, the results were not they were not satisfactory. We then reopened that. We're hoping that with a compliance officer who trains people on policies and follows up on implementation of policies and assists with enforcement and disciplinary action when there's wrongdoing, is going to improve the situation. But in the meantime, internally, there has been a process of educating people. We have a small supply chain office, and the Auditor General had raised with me the fact that we need to beef our capacity in that regard, which is absolutely needed. Thank you, ma'am. On the questions of the cases going to the IG, I have responded to that. And Honourable Adrian, I have already
I think there are people who go to the civil service. I think we should find a way of highlighting that aspect. Because I like to read even newspapers, especially Sunday newspapers, people writing articles. And you know, if you are not in South Africa reading all those things, you feel that here is a holy, holy, clean private sector worried about a corrupt civil service, you know? And that is not the situation. And I think we should find a way of using words that will show that they also must help this country stop corrupting our civil servants.
Thank you, Honourable Members, again for that very helpful feedback and candid position. I'll start with Honourable Mutsaka's question again on corruption, why I think it has reached crisis proportions. Is it because is it amount simple? Is it the number of convictions? There are corrupt people that have never gone to court, but they were administratively found to be corrupt. And in our office, Honourable Mutsaka, we get involved in investigations where there was a forensic audit that was ordered by the organ of state involved. And the organ of state placed a fortune for the forensic audit, and the forensic audit came at people for nothing, and it doesn't get reported. So we can't rely only on prosecutions and convictions. Even the NPA at that stage was even worried about prosecution, also because it takes long to prosecute. And the conversation that we had with the head of the NPA at the time was that he wanted us to strengthen administrative investigation. And in most countries, that's very strengthened. But I think you and other members have raised earlier very seriously the issue of strengthening synergies, where we probably need to sit down and say, who does what? There's no need for us to do the same thing. We can pass the baton when we're finished. And also, they are letting each other. If somebody has started a particular chairperson, they say, if somebody has started, then you can say, hey, let's wait. You conclude and we can take it because it's not running away. Of course, Honorable Schaefer was worried about timeline. So we will need them to be accountable to each other about making sure that things are done timely. But that process of making sure that once one agency has done something, it heads over to the other one smoothly, is something that seriously needs to be strengthened. From our side, the number has grown. I'm saying it's a crisis because if you compare to other countries, you don't get this complaint every day. And the upheld ones, like it's like the order of the day. You need to find a situation where corruption still shocks people, where allegations of corruption still shock people. We've reached a point where it doesn't shock anyone because it's in the media every day. But you are right, Honourable Mutsaka, that not every allegation of corruption is true. And sometimes whistleblowers are not real whistleblowers. It may be somebody who is about to lose their job or has just lost their job and then they are retaliated. Or it may be somebody who is angry with someone. From our office, we don't investigate allegations. The assessment team has a strict template that looks at what are you giving us to work with. They go back to you to ask for some documents, etc. If you just say you suspect or the wild allegations that you say things are not going right, we don't investigate. We talk about the investigation we were asked to investigate in Parliament. It wasn't really corruption, but there's so much, lots of allegations, but nothing tangible. So from our side, we don't investigate. Also, we've also made a pledge that when we do public hearings next year, we will put people under oath, so that if people are going to make allegations, they know that they honestly are attempting to things they know or reasonably think they haven't. We're not asking people to be 100% accurate, but they should reasonably suspect that there was wrong doing. Regarding the request that you have made about, oh no, the the request for the chairperson, honorable chairperson, thank you for that pledge. We haven't included the letter. We met with the CEO, who then tabled the letter at their board and they withdrew. Thank you for that. And we haven't actually had even a catered meeting with the new Minister of Communications. I think based on this, we will organize a catered meeting, which we normally do with the ministers, just to talk about what we've told them. I've heard a telephone conversation placed at one point, just some other investigation we're doing, but it's a good relationship. So thank you for that information. About the color of the report, thank you about indicating that it wasn't a commission, it was a commission, and so that not all of it has been implemented. The cost that we know about has been implemented in the office. We were also told that there was a decision in cabinet for example to detach us from government offices. Somebody told me that there was a process that would detach us, like those of us who are still going to government departments, like we are linked to justice and the CGE is linked to the Ministry for Women, Affairs, etc. I was informed at such stage that cabinet had made that decision. But it's not executed again, because to detach you got to attach. So there's a whole bunch of process on how then we will be attached to Parliament, administratively speaking, in terms of being able to get our money directly through Parliament, etc. But maybe let me just take note of what you've said about the status of the committee. And recommendations, and say, I know too much, and accept that. Thank you, Chair.
As to the last point you made about detaching you from government, it is so that there is a move towards ensuring that the Chapter 9 similar institutions obtain their budgetary funding. That's the first thing, which would greatly expand the independence of the organizations. Secondly, in the same vein, we have before us a plan called, we call it the determination of remuneration of office bearers, whose remuneration and benefits will be determined by the independent commission responsible for the determination of remuneration and benefits of all office bearers. It's members of parliament, judges, magistrates will go there. So the principles that protect, I assume, the deputy commissioners or the Human Rights Commission and so on, their salaries and benefits will be determined by that independent commission, as opposed to your coming to Parliament and asking politicians to determine the salaries. So that's, I guess, all part of the detachment from government and enhancing your independence. Any further comments, questions? You've had enough.
We're ready. Enough for good response.
In that case, then, I was going to you and your team for being with us today and sharing your experience with us. Honourable members, tomorrow we meet with Legal Aid South Africa. The venue for tomorrow's meeting is S35. Oh, I'm informed we're starting at 10 o'clock. Sorry about that. 10 o'clock, yeah? Not 9 o'clock. Okay.
I'm going to show that. Yeah.